Hello and welcome to episode 129 of the Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming podcast. It is the 16th of February 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Graham Smith.
Hello.
Marsh Davies.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
Wow.
I'll try to make our voices different because people keep saying that
they can't tell us apart. Yeah. So once again, that's Chris Thurston.
Graham Smith.
Marsh Davies.
Tom Senior.
Tom Senior sounded different that time. Don't be confused. It's the same Tom. Mm. There are two Toms, but the other one isn't here.
Confusing.
News this week.
Pod news, actually.
Is our own news.
Significant pod news. The first pod news is that we're retiring the Patreon.
Indeed.
In fact, we stealth retired it last week, so you won't be charged for last week's episode. And the reason we're doing this is that we've made fucking loads of money. well, not really.
We're all rich now. We're retiring. Thank you. Goodbye.
To Mexico. We've certainly made enough money for the pod to cover its bills for the immediate future. And that was obviously one of our objectives. It would seem almost greedy to continue taking money once we've achieved this stage. And we aren't spending it quickly enough, which is the other problem. So we're going to call it quits for the moment, and maybe at a certain point in the future we'll start it up again if we feel our pockets are short of jingly change.
To clarify, we'll probably continue to actually post the episodes to Patreon, but in order to keep the account active, but we will mark them as free. Like, you can do that when you submit whatever it is that you're making to Patreon, just say don't charge people.
Possibly. We'll have a discussion about this later.
Okay. That's almost...
Yeah. But some of the other reasons that we would stop doing it is that we said that we were going to use it to fund stuff outside of the podcast, which we may still do so with the cash we have. But we have already done so with some of these videos that I put up with Rich Stanton. But there's going to be less of that stuff from me because the other pod news is that I'm moving to Sweden.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Right now. And so I have to leave the podcast behind because I think a Skype podcast would be a cheapo shitty way of doing it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And the last thing anyone wants is a cheapo shitty Marsh.
No. Indeed.
But it's very sad news.
It is very sad news. You'll still Skype with us though, won't you, Marty?
No. You're no. Dead to me. All of you. Go on.
We can play Rainbow Six Siege together.
Oh, okay. Well, you put it like that. Yeah, of course. No, I'll still be around. I'll still be playing stuff with the community on Discord, and I'm sure I may even still be posting nonsense to the CNC YouTube channel and stuff if that's permissible. The reason being that I'm going to Sweden is I'm going to get a job with Mojang doing writing-y stuff for them.
Congratulations, Martin.
Thank you.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, sweet.
Hanging out with the old Boppo.
Yeah, Boppo. Boppo is little new baby and all the other cool Swedes who live in Sweden. And I'm not the only person who's going to be enjoying time with a new baby, am I, Graham?
No, this is true. I am not leaving the podcast, but I am going to be absent from the podcast for the foreseeable future, for I have spawned, or will do shortly. And that's obviously going to eat into both gaming time and podding time, as I shall no longer be sleeping or showering, I'm told, for there will not be time. Yes.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Maybe my baby will be a cool Swede. Who knows?
Could be. You might have to give birth to it in Sweden for that to happen. But
maybe. You know. Who knows?
There's still time.
But that's sad pod news, perhaps. But also joyful, because it is bringing new life into this world.
So, yeah, we're losing Graham for the foreseeable future, Marsh for the foreseeable Swedish future.
But
we are gaining Philippa Pip War for the foreseeable future. She's coming to Bath.
To move into this house. To replace me.
Yeah, in all things. very soon. So that, this will be in, as of probably middle of next month, but that means that while we are losing two of the five, we're going back up to four pretty straight away. So we should hopefully not see too much of a disruption of service, but obviously it's probably the most significant set of changes to what we do since we started doing this almost 3 years ago, or 2.5, 3 years ago. But
good riddance, I say. No, but genuinely, it's been great fun, and obviously I'm extremely thankful to all our listeners, and I think everybody in this room is extremely thankful for the amount of money and generosity that you've shown towards the podcast in terms of the Patreon.
Hmm. We should stress this isn't your last episode, Marsh.
No, no, I'll be around for a couple of weeks, I think, probably.
It'll be my last episode for a little while, till the baby is grown and can feed itself.
Yeah. Till the baby can be on the like
2 months.
till the baby can drink.
Yeah. Little baby podcasting.
So actually, in my new capacity as a youngster, I suppose I should get in the mood by saying everybody should play Cobalt. Very good game. Very fine game.
I did play Cobalt, in fact.
A 2D Deus Ex, I believe, according to RPS's reviewer. Perhaps madly.
At times, it feels like, he said, referring to the later levels. And there is much more to it than I was expecting.
No, it's pretty huge, actually. I'm not just chilling for it. It is impressive. I mean, I worry for it in a way because there's so much to it. It's quite hard to explain what it is. At least in a screenshot, and I think because it had an expectation of being a multiplayer game for such a long time that people probably don't really realize that it has a huge single player campaign on it as well, which is really deep in ways which defy understanding for the first couple of hours almost.
Difficult though it may be, what is Cobalt?
It's a side scrolling game where you play a robot who has cool skills.
I love cool skills.
Yeah, exactly. Well, everybody does.
Do you have to put cool skills on your CV when you go to become a cool Swede?
Yes, although I don't think putting being able to slow down bullets as they get closer to me will be one of my CV bullet points, which is a thing you can do in Cobalt.
A bullet point?
Yes.
Never mind.
It's good. And you should definitely play it and give Mojang lots of money because they don't have enough of that.
It's not made by Mojang, though. In fairness, it's made by Oxide.
Yeah. But published by Mojang.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was something else I was going to say about it as well, but I can't remember what it is.
You deflect bullets when you do forward rolls, but only if they hit your head and not your feet. If they hit the bottom of your feet, you take damage.
Mm.
And also,
it's like Deus Ex.
It's a 2D shmup, which is what, you know, the multiplayer was, but then you play the single player and then it's got stealth bits, and then it's got hacking bits, and then it's got environment puzzles,
it's
and then
got so
it's got
mini games.
Wee little AI characters that can follow you around and join your team, and dialogue trees. And
Chris Donner loved it as well for Eurogamer, and has he ever been wrong about anything? And you wouldn't tell him if he had, because he's so nice.
He is very nice.
Not to his face, anyway.
But also he hasn't. So luckily the point is moot.
Phew! IGN didn't like it, but I can now say, not being a games journalist anymore, that they were objectively wrong.
You're in that enviable position as a developer now where you can get weirdly precious.
Yeah.
And I say that as a member of the most weirdly precious writing community on Earth.
What games have you been playing this week, guys?
I've been playing Firewatch.
Yeah.
Has anyone else played Firewatch?
Finished it.
I finished it too.
Beat it.
Yeah. I finally killed the Sasquatch at the end. It was good. Really good boss battle.
I thought it was pleasant. It feels like a game that's hard to have strong feelings about. And it's full of cultural criticism on the internet, debating its various merits. And I don't understand why anyone wouldn't get to the end of it and go, that was quite nice.
Yeah.
And then move on with their lives. Like, it feels like a game that resists hating or loving.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it has generated particularly violent views one way or the other. Although, maybe it hasn't really. I mean, even the people who are threatening to kind of refund it have said they've kind of liked it. The assholes.
I'm mildly furious about this.
Yeah, it feels very much like there was a kind of spate of coming-of-age films during the early 90s, like Stand By Me, other films featuring River Phoenix. before he died. And I don't know, it has that kind of feeling of kind of like things that we did in our summer holidays that we now put behind us. Kind of nostalgic, slightly kind of melancholy, wistful, but beautiful in some way.
Yeah, being set in the 80s in the woods is, you know, a great way to evoke stuff like Stand By Me or The Goonies and all those E.T., that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Although, unlike all those things, which are about children, this is about, what, like a 40-year-old man?
I know, yeah. And it obviously doesn't fit that template of a coming-of-age film, except that there is a kind of transition in his life and a kind of understanding he reaches, which is perhaps like a coming-of-age film in that it's a story about personal responsibility to some extent. And not deciding not to run away from it or otherwise.
The Yeti, you mean?
The Yeti, yeah. The Sasquatch.
The Squatch of responsibility.
The Fire Squatch, as I think it should be called.
What do you do? Do you just want, it looks like you wander around a place, and I've no idea what else there is to it.
Yeah, do you want to explain it?
It's a first-person walking simulator in which you're talking to a lady over the radio, and she sometimes gives you tasks to complete, which involve walking or hiking or climbing to a place and doing a thing. But mostly it's about walking to a place and while on the way talking to her over the radio. So she will say things and you'll have a time to respond and a certain number of responses that you can choose from, or you can choose to ignore her. And it functions best basically as a sort of rom-com. You've got mail in a forest.
Sounds quite fun.
And it is fun, and it's well written, and the voice acting is brilliant, and it looks beautiful. But it's really hard to talk about without spoilers, because it is a purely narrative game, and there's very little branching to it.
Some people have said that they spent 6 hours or something in it. I can't really understand how they did that. I mean, I got through it in 3 hours. I didn't think I wasn't racing through it, certainly. And I did on occasions kind of try and go off the beaten path, but it really doesn't particularly reward you for that. There are occasional kind of like little kind of treats that you can pick up. Like, I went off the beaten path, I saw a raccoon. But really, you know, it doesn't seem like it. It's certainly not a branching narrative.
Achievement unlocked. Raccoon.
I really hope there's like an MLG parody air horn video for that. Right before it.
Although, I mean, in some weird ways, the narrative itself does feel like it has the potential to branch in ways that it then doesn't. There's a lot to it. And like Gone Home, it's constantly playing with the idea of what genre is this going to turn out to be? And, you know, Gone Home threatens to become like a haunted house story at certain points. It's, you know, a stormy night in this deserted house. And this weird things start happening to you and around you in the forest as you're on this fire watch. And, you know, it hints at kind of conspiracy theories, and it hints at, you know, being observed by scientists for malign purposes and all these other things. And clearly there's something going on. But the way it resolves, other people felt it was kind of anticlimactic in a way. Because I think a lot of the threads it puts before you are perhaps red herrings in some way. But I think it's intentional that you are being pulled back and forth between these different, more kind of familiar game narratives, in that they're kind of slightly over the top, lurid kind of fantasies, and yet you kind of weave the narrative just weaves straight through it all, and then kind of ends.
Is it kind of satirical take on those?
No, it's not satirical. It's not. And Graham said it was like a rom com, but it is to the extent that the characters in it are witty with each other, but the actual framing of it isn't comic. Like it is. It's a fairly serious story, really.
I feel like that stuff doesn't work so well. Like
the serious stuff, you mean?
Well, the playing with, oh, what genre is this? Which added an extra layer of tension to something like Gone Home, but was never itself, I think, acknowledged by Gone Home, as much as anything else, because the main character in Gone Home doesn't speak. If she'd gone at some point, like the internet was doing, as she was walking around the house, gone, oh, maybe they were all killed by ghosts. Yeah. Then you would have think, oh, don't be so fucking moronic. And Firewatch sort of does that, in that it puts it depicts a quite realistic down-to-earth world, and then something strange starts to happen. And you start to think, oh, is this not the genre that I thought it was? And then the game's main character decides that the sci-fi sort of thing is sort of happening. And at that point, it was just like, why would you jump to that conclusion immediately? If I was walking through the forest, I would not jump to the X-Files sort of answer to what was going on, or the Lost answer to what was going on.
Firewatch with me.
Oh.
We used that in the Mac, I think.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Oh. I worked there.
I think that the reason I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it very much. And I even like the fact that it is quite downbeat and quite grounded. But I think that it does have a problem with the way it puts these things in front of you, because it can't control that stuff as well as it would be in a completely linear narrative, like a film or a book. And as such, you're kind of players will choose their own level of engagement with any one of the kind of conspiracy theories that surround them. And so it can feel very disappointing when the actual solution to what is going on is something much more mundane, because the player's focus might just not have been on that. They might not, yeah. They wanted, you know, the player's desire is to control the narrative. And so they might be kind of pulling these threads over here, thinking that having been trained by games to assume that this will in some way branch, you know, that this, that interest in a plot line will somehow direct the narrative towards it in some way. And it doesn't. And I think the problem that people have is one that the game design just can't cope with deciding upon the player's level of interest in each of the different threads they put before them.
I wish they had either excised a lot of that stuff entirely in order to spend simply more time on the core drama of it and that relationship, which is where I think it shines best, or they had used that doubt over the genre and the character's assumption that some sci-fi type stuff or paranoia type stuff was happening to perhaps reveal something greater about the fact that they're running away from the regular world and the regular responsibilities. Like, you could have said something about that using the fact that they were so quick to jump to the more exciting conclusion. But then it just doesn't. It just feels like you get to the end and you think, wow, this guy's sort of a moron. But having said that, I liked it a great deal.
I think, you know, obviously budgets notwithstanding, if I were to have the magic wand to redesign it in an instant, I would want it to be, for one thing, I'd want it to be completely open. I would, that it is trammeled in a way which is frustrating, not simply because, it is forcing you down narrative paths that you don't particularly want, but literally it is forcing you between rocks that don't look like you should not be able to climb over them, you know. It has that problem of just not being able to signpost its navigation very well, because it goes through quite a naturalistic environment, and yet at the same time you're being fed down very linear corridors. So I want it to be a much more open space that'd be completely traversable. And I kind of want actually just to be doing Firewatchy stuff. Like, I want to have that job. I want to be going around the forest, you know, picking up cans after people and fixing, you know, telephone wires and stuff like this. And maybe somewhere dispersed in that environment is the story to be found. And that is the case, but you're kind of led towards it in a much more kind of directed way. I think it would be a much more rewarding experience if probably less saleable, I don't know, if it was just completely open and you were left completely freely to stumble across stuff. And, you know, obviously that is a huge narrative design task, but, you know, I don't feel that the solution they went for entirely satisfied me. Whether that is the only possible one they could have done or not, I don't know.
I imagine that is, as you've just said, a budget constraint, but they wring a lot out of the places that they have built, because a lot of it is about traversing the same spaces again and again, but in different lighting conditions, and it doesn't have just a free moving day night cycle. The time of day changes as you move through a space, so if you stop then the sun stops going down, and all of the lighting stuff was designed by Ollie Moss. So you're exploring this beautiful forest environments, but then you explore it at night, and then you explore it at dusk, and then you explore it at dawn, and then you explore it at midday, and it looks radically different in each one of those circumstances, such that I didn't mind so much that it was quite so trammelled through what's probably like four long corridors. I did like the map stuff as well. I quite like navigating around using a map and a compass like that. Although, yeah. I've also been playing XCOM 2.
Have you now?
XCOM Poo, more like. What?
Oh no.
Burn. I have a feeling, perhaps, that Tom Francis already ran through some of these complaints on the last pod, but I am not having very much fun with it whatsoever. It's glitchy, it's stuttery, it doesn't do a great job of explaining to you what's important. The I really wanted, after Enemy Unknown, for them to add more kind of choice and complexity to the strategy layer, so there's more to do in the geosphere, but that turns out to just be a whole bunch of stuff that interrupts you and nags you at all times, and counters and choices that I have no criteria by which to judge. It doesn't tell me when it introduces something on the map, is this going to disappear if I don't go to it right away, or do I have a days to think about it? Should I be going after that thing? Is that thing more important than this thing? Should I be doing the three missions, or should I be chasing after contacting new recruits, or should I be going for the black market thing, or did this resource disappear? And, you know, I'm just pressing a button over and over again because I want this research to finish, and it's only going to take 2 days, but I'm going to be interrupted six times on the way to there with these things that, does this matter? Why are you bringing this up? And all of these choices have the word ignore on them. And when you're just starting out in a game and you don't have the criteria for deciding what things are important, making decisions about what to ignore when we're invaded by aliens, should I be ignoring anything? I just get overwhelmed by it. And although I feel like it probably is giving me more choices, I wish I was trammeled more down available different styles of play. Like, I can't tell, is there, you know, can I optimized my squad for stealth stuff and try and just play the whole game through the weirdest shit concealment mechanic that doesn't properly depict on the tactical map, so it's hard to tell when you're about to reveal your entire team when you move through a square? Or, you know, is that not an option? Is that just like a little thing off to the side and you basically have to do the same thing as you did in Enemy Unknown? I've no idea. It's just a whole bunch of new stuff. And then it's difficult, and being difficult is the point, which means every time you don't know something or don't understand something, the way it teaches you is to kill you, and sometimes kill you in an unrecoverable way. Hey! I kind of just wish I was playing either Enemy Unknown or Invisible Link. Because, like, Invisible Link, which we championed on this podcast and lauded for the fact that it doesn't hide stuff from you. It gives you all the information you need. And although it's a stealth game, it's very good at giving you information so you can make the decisions so that you feel like you're to blame. And in XCOM 2, I don't have the information, and I'll play four missions where I encounter the same enemy, and then on the fourth mission, it'll use an ability I didn't know it had. And then on the fifth mission, it will climb up onto the roof of a building to attack me, and then it will glitch through the floor of the roof of that building two stories down, but then still attack me from down there and do damage. And then a snake tongue will pass through the layers of cover, grab me from the other side, and pull me through the geometry of the level, because it treats snake tongues in the same way as it does bullets where you're shooting them around corners.
Come on, Tom, fight him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recognize most of that from what I played of it. I found that if you look at, you can observe all of the soldiers' skill trees and see what they will be able to do in the future when they level up. And in battles, you can press a button that pops out a little square that tells you all of the chances and, you know, the positive and the negative percentage rolls on chance shots. And in fact, I think it gives you way more ways of mitigating the chance stuff that was in Enemy Unknown. And I found it to be much clearer, actually, than, so for example, the satellite mechanic in Enemy Unknown was an invisible punishment mechanic, and there was nothing you could do about it. That just screwed you the first time because it never told you that was really important. But when something is really important in XCOM 2, it's literally a big blaring bwah, bwah, bwah. And if it's honking at you, yeah, you probably do that. And if it's a big red kind of mission machine, probably don't press ignore if it's just going, warning, warning, warning.
But very few of the things actually do that. The four or five different things I just described, they don't do that. They just pop up and say, hey, you can do this if you want.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I don't know. Do I want?
But they clearly lay out what the benefits and negatives are for doing one of those missions. So every so often, it'll give you a choice of three missions, and they will counter these dark events the aliens are working on. It'll also say you'll get a scientist for doing this. And then obviously by being in the battle, your soldiers have the ability, chance to level up, which is obviously hugely important because you need to keep up with the power curve of the game. So I don't understand why, like, where the confusion comes from. There are a lot of different resources eventually, but initially it's just supplies. That's what you care about initially. It's just, you know, you need supplies to buy things. Mm. And that's all you have to go for. And then later on it introduces Illyrium, but that's like for high-end stuff. And I thought it was very streamlined, actually, in that way.
I agree with Tom. and actually, I would say this, having played a hard XCOM 1, or not XCOM 1, as in Enemy Unknown, campaign right before starting XCOM 2, and XCOM Enemy Unknown has a problem, I think, where it makes a lot of the most important resources very abstract and not really feel like resources. So money is something you get in kind of uncertain quantities, and you'll lose over time based on losing people from the council and that kind of thing, or by putting satellites up. And Tom, the satellites are the perfect example of the most important thing to build as fast as possible, or you will lose, and it does not say that anywhere. Mm. That's like you fail first, and you fail the whole campaign first, and then you learn that. But also things like engineers speeding up research time and scientists speeding up research time and engineers speeding up build time is super, super important. Mm. But the correlation between getting four new engineers and how quickly that allows you to build those satellites that you desperately need isn't very obvious. And it's only something you learn deep into your experience of the game, I find, before you kind of go, when you get in XCOM, an Enemy Unknown, when you could give them that choice of three missions to go on, and one of them's like new guy, one of them's $200, and one of them's four engineers. Sometimes in the early game, the best choice you can make is four engineers, because that means you get your next satellite X amount of time faster. Mm. But even now, having played hundreds of hours of that game, I couldn't tell you what the exact time difference is. Whereas the way they've changed personnel in XCOM 2 to be actual people. So it's not just engineers in abstract, a quantity of them. It's like, you got this guy, and then you can assign this guy to engineering tasks around the ship. And they speed those things up by a number that you're given. And so suddenly, I found that I agree with Graham that there's a lot of options very quickly, like balancing supplies against intel, against engineers and new crew and stuff like that. I found that My reading of it was that I knew exactly what I would get from each of those things in a way I didn't in XCOM 1, and even on my first go. And I mentioned last week how badly my first go is going. And so I found those decisions easier to make, because in XCOM 1, I would just always go for money. Because it's like, if I have money, I can buy things. I can buy soldiers. I can buy whatever. So I would always just go for money, because I didn't really understand the timings and stuff, the weighting of the other stuff. Whereas now it's like, actually, a new engineer means I can double how quickly I can clear new rooms in the ship, and clearing new rooms in the ship gets you money. So it's like, I just took a load of casualties, and yeah, getting a new high ranking soldier right now sounds amazing. So I'm going to do that, because the increased casualty rate helps, I think, make that feel more valuable. Hmm. So I agree that there's lots of options, but I think it feels more like it feels overwhelming, but more equitable on a first go. And I expect better for subsequent campaigns, that more meaningful decisions are introduced more early, as opposed to XCOM 1, where it's like, speed up those satellites and then worry about everything else.
Hmm. Yeah, there's stuff I was surprised to hear you say that about the stealth stuff in combat, especially with relation to Invisible Ink, because it shows clearly the vision of the enemies and things around you as red squares on the floor. And if you move through them, then on the path, it flags up when you're moving through that, and it even does it if you're moving through a door that you will have to bust through loudly. So it's always telling you when you're about to break stealth. The thing you have to navigate is the fact that enemies move, and therefore you have to expect those vision areas to shift. But that's just the game of just, I think, when you see a squad, you might have to spend a turn watching, see where they'll go, just be a bit more conservative, put more people on Overwatch, etc.
I've had instances where I've moved to a square where it didn't come up with the little eye to tell me I was going to be revealed if I went there, and then moved there and was immediately spotted and revealed everyone. I've also had lots of other bugs, like characters falling through the floor, but also if you're doing a mission where you have to rescue civilians, and you do that by moving into an area of effect around them. Mm. But if they move close to you so that you're within that area of effect, that doesn't count. And then I had two turns of moving within that area of effect and that not doing anything. And then I had to move out of the area of effect and then move back in. Mm. And then it registered that they were close enough to me that I could rescue them. And stuff like that, when you're playing a game which is difficult and you've just wasted three turns. And that little eye not appearing and you moving to a space and suddenly all of your squad is revealed. That's really punishing.
Yeah. I totally agree with you on the bugs, for what it's worth. I'm completely with you on that.
You just mentioned that you'd played a couple hundred hours of Enemy Unknown. How much of Enemy Unknown did you play, Tom?
Probably about 100 hours.
Okay, because I think I played probably around 30, and I wonder if that's a big difference. Mm. Because when I get offered the choice between missions that will get me a scientist or an engineer or some money, or I can do this other thing that will get me intel, I don't know which of any of those things is best? Should I be like, do I want scientists more? Do I want engineers? And there are points along in the campaign where it will say, oh, you need to unlock this new room. And so I understand, okay, I need to clear alien debris so I can get that new room, and that goes faster if I have an engineer. But then there are just points where it's giving me those options, and it's not clear which of those I should be prioritizing, because it hasn't given me a goal yet which is relevant to those things, and I don't understand enough of the kind of long view of a campaign to understand, you know, what should I be preparing for, what is the end game of this thing to be, because I have no frame of reference because I never completed Enemy Unknown.
Even then, I think you're at a disadvantage in the first campaign, particularly with the technology and not knowing the fastest way to the first armor tier, for example, is a big deal. I think that's where people have been struggling with difficulty, because hitting the first armor tier is massive. And as soon as you have more armor, then that reduces how punishing it is. But there's a strong element of hindsight to that. I still had an amazing time in my first playthrough, and it does get better on subsequent playthroughs, but I had an amazing time in the first playthrough because it's supposed to be dogging you all the time, and it's supposed to be, the whole fantasy of the game is that it's hounding you, and that you're in such a severe position of disadvantage in that context that you're always on the brink of disaster, and that's what the game is about, I think. And so that's when it's throwing things at you. So it's like you're trying to juggle these resources and improve your situation, but it's throwing bricks at the side of your head all the time. And that's the nature of the game, I think. That's kind of a part of the experience.
I think something it suffers for is that other games, even previous XCOM and XCOM style games, have taught you that you are fucked in a certain situation, that you don't appear to be fully fucked in an XCOM 2. You'll really feel like you're fucked, but you can actually come back from it. And that's, like, it's almost impossible for the game to communicate that, because it has to reach out to you and go, this isn't like the games. Like, it needs the character to go in like, well, that was terrible, we lost everybody, but I don't think we're completely fucked. But you might think I'm not just saying that. I'm saying that because I specifically think you, the player, will think that you're fucked, but you're not. Anyway, I was from Firaxis. Goodbye.
I actually push through that stuff, because there are situations where you are completely broken. If you get a squad wipe, it's over in Enemy Unknown, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's not the case at all in XCOM 2. And it's supposed to have these peaks and troughs in your campaign when you're flying high and you're put down to the bottom. You have to kind of claw your way back again. That's the drama of the game, I think. And I think it's been very intentionally designed to provoke that kind of reaction.
That was the stuff that I enjoyed in Enemy Unknown. I like hard games. I want my back to be against the wall, so to speak. But I wish a lot of the time that my back was against the wall because I was making choices to individualize my squad to prepare for certain eventualities, and then, the one alien type I didn't want to show up showed up in a mission, kind of thing. Whereas a lot of the time at the moment, I'm feeling like I'm fucked because it introduces an alien type or an ability for an alien I just simply didn't know existed. And so I was making decisions based on incorrect data. And I think that will get better on subsequent playthroughs, but we champion games all the time when they, you know, introduce a new alien type from the other side of a sheet of glass so you can see what it does before you shoot it, you know, the Valve style of enemy introduction. And I know that's very counter to the ethos of XCOM, but I think it would be a better game probably if it just adopted that, if it just said, hey, look, this is what this guy is, this is what that guy can do. That guy can still be able to fuck me up completely, and I'm very happy to not have, you know, a great set of abilities to counter that guy right away or anything like that, and still have to work out how to deal with it and how to level up in order to deal with it. But just not knowing and the punishment for not knowing being so high means that I wasn't having a great deal of fun.
I could see that, but some of my best moments were the introduction of those enemies, and I found them incredibly exciting to discover. And the only way that you discover things in XCOM is by being killed by them. That's just XCOM. That's always been what XCOM is like, and that's just a strong part of the character of the game. And so, like, there's an enemy called the Codex, which is just obscene. When it first comes in, the stuff it can do is unbelievable, and you think it's impossible, that there's no way you could ever cope with it. And but bearing in mind that you can extract at any time in XCOM 2, you can throw down an extraction area and say, fuck this, I'm out. It's just that 100 supplies or that VIP, like, there's a wipe on the cards here of just not going to do it. I'm going to go into this building, out the other side, and I'm going to rope up back into the Sky Ranger and go home. And you're completely free to do that at any time in XCOM 2. And that's a very significant thing. I think Yeah. Again, it maybe doesn't explain that very well. Yeah.
Again, and like, I know you can do that as an ability, but that's a hard ability to use when you don't quite understand what the stakes are. Like, you know, like you just talked about, there were ways in which it was possible to fuck up in the early game in EU that just fucked you entirely for the campaign. And so when I'm doing a mission in XCOM 2, I don't know, you know, do I have to risk it all in order to get this? Because if I abandon this and we're going to turn out that I'm just fucked, I'm too far behind the curve. Mm. I have no way of knowing. And a lot of it is just like, okay, this snake men and women turned out to have a tongue ability where they can grab you and pull you in. I didn't know that until I first saw it, but it made sense because they're snakes and snakes have tongues.
It's like geckos.
But, you know, I know that snakes can't actually, you know, do that in real life, but it still kind of fits with the fiction. But a snake was stood in front of a truck and I was stood on the flatbed around the other side of the truck behind some boxes and its tongue went through the front of the truck, through the floor of the flatbed, through the boxes I was hid behind and grabbed me and then pulled me around. And there was nothing about the aesthetic of the game that was communicating that that would happen. And I kind of, after it's happened, I understand, oh, okay, I understand how the system works, that it thinks this is possible, but that's not really...
No, that's definitely a bug. But I hardly came across any bugs, and it ran brilliantly for me.
It's so weird, because I feel like really in the middle ground, because I think it's a beautifully designed game, and I actually did want to mention Invisible Ink, but in a separate thing, like, because I think they're comparable in some ways, maybe. But yeah, for me, it's really, really stuttery. My PC isn't amazing, but it should be able to handle this, and regularly buggy in the way that Graham describes. Like, walls don't really matter to aliens, that kind of thing.
That's really strange. I mean, people can fall through floors if the building's on fire. And like that kind of stuff happens, but it sounds like that behavior is happening just in ways that visually don't make sense. But when I like it's blatant, that stuff, like you notice it if you're reviewing it for 30 hours that when that stuff was happening, and it just wasn't on a regular basis. Occasionally an angle would be a bit odd where an alien would kind of go around a corner and there'd be a window, but the alignment was wrong, so it'd shoot through the wall. And that still makes sense in the game logic, but a snake shouldn't be able to throw his tongue through a car. And If it behaved like bullets, he wouldn't be able to shoot you, because if you're on the other side of that object, you would just be in cover and out of sight.
Oh. But I think what it was he was on, you know, the truck was two grid squares wide, and he was on the kind of right-hand square, and then the box I was hid behind, I was also on the right-hand square, so you probably could have targeted with the guns, because it does the thing where if you target with the guns, everyone leans around the corner and is like, hello! And so I think it just treats tongues in the same way as it does bullets, which makes sense in retrospect, but tongues aren't bullets. I downloaded a mod called Stop Wasting My Time, and that helped a lot, because a lot of the stutters I was experiencing weren't because my computer was struggling with it. It was just there are lots of pauses in the combat. Like when a sectoid casts the ability to bring a fallen soldier back to life, and he casts the ability, and then there's like a 4-second pause before the soldier comes back to life. This mod just gets rid of that. And, you know, makes it half a second long pause, and there's all these kinds of different pauses throughout, and that makes it feel much nicer to play. But there's still just weird things where the camera will pan off to some fog to show you the movements of aliens that you can't see. So I'm going to take control of your camera now to show you basically a blank screen for the next 15 seconds.
It's all of that.
Just that's weird.
The thing I was going to say about Invisible Ink, because I think it's an interesting comparison and a more favorable one to XCOM 2 than I think maybe you would make, is that Invisible Ink, I think, hides its experimental side, like the kind of experimenting with builds and stuff is something that you really do not do until you've played quite a lot of that game, because a lot of the time you have to actively seek it out. You have to choose the missions that will let you experiment with builds and loadouts and stuff like that. So in terms of the amount of decisions you're asked to make, you're not asked to make very many. There's a lot of decisions you could make. But if you're just playing and learning the game for the first time, it actively hides its complexity. It'd be a bit like if you had to pick a mission in XCOM a specific type of mission in order to be able to upgrade your soldiers. That would be the direct analog, and therefore you would never see the skill tree stuff or have to think about it because you would just choose something else. But the other thing is XCOM is a much more AI-driven game when the AI is working. I mean, so many of the bugs are bad because it means that the AI isn't behaving according to what you might anticipate that it would do.
Yeah.
But it's a question of anticipation, where there is a not always a certain chance that you're going to be right. Whereas Invisible Ink is a game where you're always going to be right about what the AI will do.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much. Like, it's a game you have a lot more power in terms of, you know, exactly where they're going to move next turn. You know exactly how they'll react to certain things you do. And there's weirdness in XCOM. But I think the AI is, on the whole, quite good. Mm-hmm. And it creates interesting scenarios because something will happen. It's like, shit, I just didn't expect this alien to do this. And then in turn, and this is true of Enemy Unknown to a degree as well, it encourages you to start thinking differently. Like, Invisible Ink is like a board game because there's usually a series of correct moves to solve the chamber, or more like a puzzle game. Like, there's a series of correct moves that will keep you hidden and allow you to be in the right squares to incapacitate the right people at the right time to solve this spatial puzzle that you're solving. Whereas XCOM feels like that because you always want to be in big cover and you always want to be on Overwatch because Overwatch feels safer than everything else. But actually, that's not always true. Like, mm-hmm. And I think for me, the reason I love that game so much is it was like the moment my brain opened up and I stopped seeing it in terms of like, do the safe move, put everyone in Overwatch slowly, particularly when Enemy Within came in and now XCOM 2 and there are far more time constraints.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I have to figure out how to do this in two turns. Like, I'm not allowed to just do the geometrically perfect thing. I have to do the thing where one guy just runs out into the middle of fucking nowhere and throws a grenade in the hopes that it will destroy an area of cover that will encourage the AI to want to reposition rather than kill the people I don't want it to kill. And that kind of thing, where it's like, in a sense, compared to something Invisible Ink, and I do think Invisible Ink is an amazing game, what XCOM offers when it's really working is like, feels a little bit higher level because it feels more improvisational and kind of exciting and systemic.
Yeah, so many great options as well, like as your guys level up, like the ways that you can do damage or manipulate enemies is really exciting in terms of the various kind of gas grenades you can use to disrupt enemy behavior, the ability to just throw out a robot to zap someone and gain, like, again, I think if you get below half health, you hope they'll go for better cover instead of pressing forwards. And the Rangers, I just love the Ranger class. And this class that you go down the stealth route, they just play a completely different game to everyone else on the board. Like, they are just still in this different rule set that sets them apart. And you can set up these brilliant kind of, if you really, there are characters, enemies you really need to blow up quickly because they get out of hand. And when one of those turns up and your Ranger's in stealth, it's like, this is your moment, Ranger, to come out and hit him with that sword and get this massive, massive damage bonus. But then, of course, by doing that, he reveals himself and, the rest of your squad has to protect him then and be on Overwatch or be targeting people who might target him. And I just find it endlessly fascinating as a combat game, and as just a building, character building game as well. In terms of the different ways that you can level your guys up, like the PsyOps class, the different armor types you can go for and the kind of experimental weapons that you can use. I think as a sequel, it expands on
XCOMs
and gives you far more creative, you know, rewards your creativity in much more interesting ways.
I feel like I will come to agree with you after I've played it for 15 more hours. Yeah, that's how I feel at the moment.
I feel like you got the best possible first experience of it, because I feel somewhere in the middle where I agree with you on the design of the thing, but I'm probably going to stop playing it and wait for them to either patch it or for me to get a new PC, because it's not fun.
That's
and
true.
Like dealing with them shooting through walls and stuff, it ruins that fantasy of that moment of perfect improvisation. Like, it needs to be somewhere. Like, it does. I don't think they need to change the design too much. I just think the game needs to be stable.
Just work better. Mm. Well, I look forward to it working better.
You've been playing something else that's quite buggy, I hear, Tom.
Well, I'm not sure Street Fighter V is buggy in its core kind of combat and when you're actually fighting a man, but in terms of the infrastructure and just the game itself, it's definitely half a thing.
Oh, really?
That is being sold for £45.
How did this happen then? I've not followed the story behind it, but it just seemed like Twitter was ablaze with hate for it today. I'm not quite sure why.
There's a disturbance in the force and a thousand Ryus cried fuck this. It released without the most basic kind of modes and functions you'd expect from a fighting game. And they've been very transparent about the fact that the main story campaign is a few months down the line. But there is no way to fight the computer for a round. There's no way to just like start a fight with the computer for a round.
I was looking for that in the menu earlier today.
Yeah, it's not there. They've got like a survival mode. They've got some really piss-weak kind of mini gauntlets for each character. they've got a desperately poor tutorial. I've been like all over the internet today learning what the actual systems are, how they actually work in that game.
They display the wrong tutorial messages at different points during that, because they're telling you to do a kick, and actually what you need to do in that moment is a punch and stuff like that.
It's much worse than that as well. Like there's stuff like the EX moves are a big part of this game, and it tells you how to do one with Ryu, and you press these two buttons and he'll just kind of like glow a bit.
Mm.
And that the tutorial ends there.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. So what does that mean? I haven't hit anybody since then.
What does that mean? Yeah, and it doesn't tell you that EX attacks are different for every character. Like they have a different effect. So for Ryu, it'll give him like lightning fists, and they will stun enemies for a longer amount of time and give you open up new combos that he wouldn't otherwise have access to. Whereas someone else, you press it, and his dreadlocks are unleashed and they catch fire. And all of his moves become different. So every character has a lot of depth and interesting stuff going on, but there's no way you could possibly access it as a newcomer without trawling through a lot of kind of YouTube videos made by people who've played the beta. And it doesn't tell you combos in the command list or anything, and it will give you kind of the lightest introduction to each character. And it's such a complicated kind of complex fighting game. It doesn't even teach you like the core concepts of how it works, which I've had to just learn today. So my New Year's gaming resolution was to get into Street Fighter, because I've never played Street Fighter. But I love watching it, even though I barely understand what's going on. And I thought this was my chance, because Capcom have said this is going to be great for newcomers. They've said that, and in many ways, in terms of the kind of the openings and windows, the frame openings in order to execute combos, is far more forgiving than Street Fighter Ultra 4, which I've also tried. And it's also, like, in terms of the button presses that you need to do to execute some of the most powerful moves, it seems far simpler to me than Street Fighter 4 as well. And in the actual fights, there's a lot they've done to make you just more able to execute what you're attempting to execute at any time. If you want a Hadouken, it doesn't have to be quite as precise to make that happen. But if you don't know what the difference between a rush character and like a throw character, or the archetypes that Street Fighter operates on, then you have no hope. And it doesn't give you the tools with which to progress from there. You're just completely dead in the water. And without like studying it like a real martial art or something, you're going to be fucked forever until they gradually introduce a tutorial.
Other than saying that it would be good for newcomers, what are the other kind of marquee features of Street Fighter V? What does it add over and above Street Fighter IV?
It's a total redesign of the game. It's not like a revision, like a FIFA sequel might be. Like, they have redesigned every single character they have within the parameters of what they, like a Street Fighter number shift is historically a big deal, because they like the Ultras and the Turbos and the Supers versions of each game, those are the patches, and then the new games are legitimately new games with new top level systems and stuff like that. I haven't played 5 yet, so I can't speak to it exactly, but just to, it is like they take the whole game apart and then put it back together again.
So what is one of the new fighting system features then? Like, is it just a case of, the punches and kicks are different, or is it, there is a whole new...
There are new mechanics. The EX mechanic is new. There is a kind of guard break function it does that is new. And the way it operates seems to be different to the way previous Street Fighter kind of super modes.
4 had EX, but it was something else.
Okay.
Like, it was the same concept, but it was in a different way. So,
Or maybe called V-Skill, actually, in the new game.
Yes, it might be. No, yeah. EX and V-Skill are separate things. A V-Skill has replaced the Ultra Bar, as far as I know.
Yeah, so V-Skill's are...
V-Skill's replaced the Ultra Bar! Outrage!
Well, you know how much I love nonsense, right? I was into Street Fighter 4 and any of the other competitive things years ago.
Yeah, it looks fantastic, and the character designs are just nuts.
Really good. Yeah. Well, I mean, if a bit titsy in places.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, Street Fighter's female character design is really different to other fighting games, but still problematic in the same way tradition is. Like, they're as huge and muscular as well as Tetsu. I think is the only thing that redeems it. Like, everyone in that game looks like they could kick the shit out of you, which is probably good compared to something like Dead or Alive.
Yeah, Chun-Li has massive, massive muscular thighs.
Yeah.
Famously so. And then one of the new characters is not a traditional body type for a beautiful female protagonist. Usually they are lithe and wispy creatures, but you know, she actually looks like she's proportioned like a real person who can actually survive in combat.
I mean, the thing about Street Fighter is, like, if you're into it, these things are, like, earth-shatteringly different. But if you're not, then maybe it's not such a big deal. Like, they've redesigned Ken quite substantially, like, visually and in terms of how he works to differentiate him from Ryu.
Is it Ryu?
It's Ryu, yeah.
Oh, my God. I've been calling him Ryu like a moron for years.
I think I started out in this podcast calling him Ryu and then switched halfway through. So, covering both bases.
I'm actually really disappointed because I'd sort of been half following it and I love Street Fighter 4. And when they said we'll have a cinematic single player thing a couple of months down the line, I thought that was fine because it's never had that. Mm. Like, that's like how Mortal Kombat works now. And great, cool that they're doing it, but whatever. But I took from that to mean, so the base game will have the normal Street Fighter set of things like arcade mode and, you know, a dojo for training and leaderboards and individual lengthy individual character specific combo training and all the rest of things that come in the base game. And then they'll bolt on new skins and new characters and a little single player thing. And that's fine. But the fact that it comes with like a third of what Street Fighter would previously come with and isn't even gaining that, presumably ever in some cases, like they haven't said dates for stuff like combo training, which like that's how you learn that game when you're not, you know, playing with other people or against other people.
I don't know what I'm going to do because I need to stick to my gaming resolution, but it's going to involve
play Street Fighter 4.
Yeah, I will. But it was fascinating because I found a dusty old arcade stick in the office and plugged it in, and it's the first time I've ever used an arcade stick, and Street Fighter makes sense to me for the first time.
You don't want to playing it on a pad is crippling, really.
The first time I tried to play Street Fighter 4, it was on the Xbox 360 controller, which like trying to do Ryu's uppercut is like massaging a wine gum with your thumb with that D-pad. And there's just no way it's ever going to happen because it's like a zigzag. It's like toward down toward punch.
Yeah, it's like an S shape, basically.
Yeah, it's like, and doing that motion on a fight stick is completely natural and feels completely different to the Hadouken. And there's a really tactile pleasure to using a fight stick that I never knew existed, and makes me want to persist with it in a way that I didn't expect, actually, because it's such a lovely little clicky thing. I watched a YouTube video on like how to actually just hold it, like how the pros hold it and how you actually kind of manipulate it and how not to mash it, but to actually kind of play it like a piano, as he said. And I was like, well, you're kind of full of shit in a way, but I'm definitely going to follow all of your advice and actually try and do it really properly
and dig out my fight stick.
Have you got a fight stick?
Yeah. Well, I used to be really into Street Fighter 4. When I was a freelancer, therefore basically unemployed, rather than between failing to find work, I would just play StarCraft and Street Fighter all day.
Yeah.
And attempt to be good at competitive games. I was terrible at both of them, and then I discovered Dota.
This is one of the fun things about living. Yeah, I live in the office. Going to work with an office full of just game journalists in the same place is that everyone gets into a fighting game at the same time, especially if it's as big as Street Fighter, and half of them own like sticks and stuff, and they just sit around at lunchtime on couches. And I'm not good enough to be in that gang yet, so yeah. I'm in the training montage phase, and in about 6 months, I'm going to sit down at the on the leather couch next to them and be like, plug me in.
I remember Nathan Brown's going to kick your ass.
Yeah. Nathan Brown won like the games industry Street Fighter tournament E3 one year.
Yeah,
and that's like all of them. But yeah, I remember when I came down to Bath, like there were two things I knew competitively. One was StarCraft and the other was Street Fighter. And then so like the first thing was like Rich McCormick saying like, oh, finally someone to play StarCraft with. And then he just absolutely ruined me inside out because he's really good and I was terrible. Apart from when we did that big group game for the PC Gamer Olympics feature. Yeah, and he was so annoyed that I won that. But only because everyone else teamed up on him. But then I went over to those guys to play Street Fighter. It's like, I played a bit of Street Fighter. And it's like, I'm going back now. I'm just going to climb into the bin. So, yeah. But you and I should play, Tom.
Because
I'm rusty as fuck. And yeah.
You can teach me how it works.
I don't know five at all as well, which is the thing.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Be fun.
What have you been playing, Martin?
Firewatch. I think that's it, really. Did I finish Tomb Raider last time?
Yes.
Did I tell you about killing the boss with a bean can?
No.
Okay, so yeah, there's the ending of Tomb Raider is like one of the worst endings to any game ever. In terms of it just falling apart, like I have a feeling that they didn't how they hadn't finished like the, one of the main boss battles in it. So you fight this helicopter towards the end, spoilers. and the helicopter does the kind of things you, that helicopters do in boss battles, which is that they stand very still while you shoot it and destroy it, and then does strafing runs pointlessly. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't feel right. It's trivially easy. You can, except for the fact that you can be killed during cutscenes, which periodically punctuate the fight. Which is slightly annoying. Then there's a weird stealth section, which again is just bizarrely easy, like way easier than any other stealth section in the game, insultingly so. And then you fight the big, sort of pseudo big bad guy. And he knocks you out in a cutscene. Of course he does, with the butt of his gun, and takes all your weapons. But he does that by taking just your bow off your shoulder, and then obviously all of your armory is gone, even though you are fucking, you've got like four other ways of killing people attached to you. Then you do this crap stealth fight with him, basically, and he's lying on the ground, kind of mouthing off about your dead dad. And obviously what you're meant to do at that point is either leave, and I assume he gets crushed by falling masonry or some other kind of thing, or you blow him away with your suddenly magically recouped armory. But I noticed that there was a bean can on the floor, and bean cans, which obviously litter all ancient ruins, can instantly be turned into grenades, but you can just pick them up and use them as bean cans. As throwable objects.
Okay.
So I picked it up and I lobbed it at him, and it cut to a cutscene of him flying back going, as though he'd been shot with a blast of a shotgun.
It must do like one damage or something. That's enough to register. That's awesome.
Yeah. And that's how that game ends.
Did you know that it got an award from the Screenwriters Guild for its writing?
Yes, I think the Screenwriters Guild only awards things to people who signed up to the Screenwriters Guild.
Ah. Yeah, you have to pay a fee to sign up, pay your dues.
I just wanted to know how you felt about that, Martin, in a sound.
I'm very happy for the team. I think, you get what kind of, you glory you seek in life, don't you, Rinny?
He said, prepping his bean can.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. I'm sad for all the, and you know, I don't object to people getting awards if they're the kind of, you know, if you're the kind of, I don't know. I mean, it's like award ceremonies or anything. It's kind of meaningless, and people who seek awards tend to win awards.
Yeah.
It's sad that the world generally doesn't recognize better things, but I don't, good for them, you know.
Would you say, on the whole, that Rise of the Tomb Raider is worth playing? You talked about it on the last few pods and sounded variously positive and negative about it, but as a, should I play it? Should I complete it?
Don't know.
Do you regret the time that you've spent playing it? Well, okay, probably I'll skip this one.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it, there's a decent game within it for about 7 to 10 hours, and there's a lot of pointless, annoying craft and
remember, you're a craft, Lara. If I was to play just one game, should I play Rise of the Tomb Raider or The Witness?
Oh, The Witness.
Okay.
They're quite different games, though.
Like, but solving a maze puzzle with a bean can.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Robert writes, "Dear Creighton Crowbar, I laughed at Tom Francis' description last week of hapless Lara being ambushed by Philistine thugs while attempting to decipher an ancient text. This reminded me of a similar occurrence that happened to me years ago while playing the original best Fallout. My questing had taken me to the Glow, and after failing miserably in my first attempt, I tried again, this time after necking a great deal of Radex. I was near the end when I had to pop open the inventory for some reason, and accidentally right-clicked on a copy of the skill book, Dean's Electronics. The screen faded to black and back again, with my character having spent the previous 8 hours leafing through a book to buff his repair skill by 8% while in a highly radioactive area.
Oh, God.
All effects of the Radex having long since faded away. Needless to say, my character's radiation levels were sky high and I was all out of Radaway, so it was a painful, lonely death after clawing the way back to the surface. You've already mentioned one case of this, but have you had any other humorously frustrating cases of game controls or interface making you do blatantly stupid things? Regards, Robert."
I always have a problem, a recurring problem in Dota now, where if you are trying to buy an item that is like non-standard for your character, or just simply isn't in the default recommended items for your character, the easiest way to find it is to start typing its name into the search box. And like, I haven't played like Typing of the Dead or like Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing for like a long time. So this is my only encounter with games where not being able to fucking type, you moron, is actually like sometimes of real serious importance. Like you'll just be like, the amount of times I've forgotten how to spell, arcane, travel, getting BLB, that sort of thing. BLT isn't a thing. And you end up in these awkward situations where they came to my mind because I died a couple of days ago and had to say, I'm really sorry, guys. I couldn't spell necro twice. And by the time I was typing forward slash like a prick, I was already dead.
Tragic story.
Yeah. I can't type as the
receiver, which that's a good one of the games I always talk about, but it's a game about this basically. It's a first person shooter where your gun is a distinct set of parts. So you have to press one button to take the clip out, one button to empty all the spent shells out of the clip, one button to keep pressing it to put new bullets into the clip, that sort of thing. Which means that you're often trying to do this while little jabbery electrocution robots are spinning their way towards you. Mm. And it's really easy to, you know, instead of firing your last bullet, just drop the bullet down some stairs in your panic and haste.
I was pedentified on YouTube the other week, as in I was attacked by a pedant.
Oh, okay.
I was going for identified as a, and yeah, I wasn't sure.
Who corrected me on the usage of clip. Apparently a clip is not the same thing as a magazine.
This is true, actually. I know this, in fact. A clip is a small rubbery thing that holds just a few number of bullets, whereas a magazine is the thing that actually slides in and out these days of guns.
Print is pretty sexy.
My stupidity comes from terrible brinksmanship with poison effects, where I never immediately cure the poison because I always think I might get away with it. You know, when you've been affected by something in a game and it's going to tick away a certain amount, but it's going to do it slowly in a way that you can't necessarily envision how much of your health bar it's going to delete.
Mm.
So I just wait and wait and wait, and then sometimes just forget and die. As Marsh has literally seen me do this in Dark Souls 2.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like, I'm just going to let that slowly erase my... And Marsha's like, what are you doing? You're gonna die. That's fine, Marsha. It's fine. Keels over. 10,000 souls lost.
empty flask to your lips.
Yeah, actually. Literally the case.
Cameron writes, whilst you all have very distinctive voices, I find myself forgetting the name/voice link shortly after the introductions, possibly because I like to listen as I go to sleep. Very soothing sounds. Wake up, Cameron! As a result, I have trouble relating your stories to my uninterested wife. Could all of you please say your name before each statement in the future? That will help greatly. Thanks in advance, Cameron.
This is Chris? No.
James writes, hi guys, I was listening to episode 127 wherein you talked about science in games and thought I'd share my experience with a lesser known Paradox grand strategy game, Victoria 2. In Victoria, you have a research tree as normal. Research points are gained by increasing the literacy of your population. But the interesting part is the discovery mechanic. By completing research in a general area, say medicine, you become eligible to discover additional tech by random chance as you play, such as vaccines and such. These unlocks are often vastly more powerful than the initial tech itself. Completely separate parts of the tech tree even overlap in these discoveries, making you more likely to trigger them, and being the first to make a discovery often means a more significant benefit than being late to the party. Anyway, I thought you'd be interested to know. Keep up the great work, James. I was interested to know.
That is interesting.
I love the fact that there is a Paradox strategy game called Victoria that sold well enough to get a sequel. David writes, some terribly misinformed people who believe video games are the source of all societal decay have, somehow, acquired a time machine. They are racing backward in order to prevent the creation of three of the most influential game companies, And the belief that this will kill the whole industry dead. It won't, but any company they hit will never have existed. All its games, and perhaps more importantly, its influence on the medium will be gone forever. They are targeting Valve, Blizzard, and BioWare, and you, brave heroes, can save only two of them. Because of the poorly written and contradictory rules of time travel. Which company do you consign to non-existence? Thanks for a great podcast, David.
I'd say easily BioWare.
Well, I'd say BioWare is the one that you definitely say.
I'd say definitely say Blizzard. I would. I'm in two minds about whether even,
all right,
even
Hotspoy.
As much as I love Valve. No. I think Blizzard is important for WoW, which is a game I never particularly loved. But you know, they've had a much more significant impact on the industry than I think BioWare has.
It's not about impact though. It's about what would be there if they weren't. And the thing is, like Valve, Valve best stuff is Half-Life. Obviously, is great, but it's itself, you know, grew out of games that pre-existed it. It's their most important games now. Counter-Strike, TF2, Dota, all existed without them, and probably would find form one way or another. Even Blizzard, like, you know, Games Workshop are making more games now. They'd have gotten around to figuring out how to make games out of Games Workshop licenses a while ago.
I don't think the fictional setting of Blizzard's games are what set them apart.
No, but,
though, right?
You know, I think Blizzard make almost a stronger case. And I say that as a Dota fanboy, like, but BioWare, like, genuinely have made things that I don't think wouldn't have existed without those people in the same. Like, there's actually genuine.
Yeah, no loss.
Genuine newness in the Mass Effect series and in Dragon Age and even Jade Empire and KOTOR and stuff like that. Like that point where narrative stuff met action game and that kind of thing.
But when, like, Richard Garriott was making RPGs, like Ultima, which was broadly comparable to stuff like Baldur's Gate, and wouldn't, you know, the rush of narrative games and action gaming eventually have crashed into RPGs either way, even if BioWare went wants to do it?
Possibly.
And isn't the greater loss of Valve just Steam?
Yeah.
You know, but someone would have made a shop.
I don't know. Well, I mean, they didn't. That's why true. Steam appeared, because Microsoft refused to step up for years and years and years. And why Steam was crap for fucking decades.
There's still no great competitor to Steam. Like, that's what's absurd. It's such a large market, and Origin and Uplay and all these other things are still a bit
about
pitch.
Their catalogs. And so, why would EA let Ubisoft's products onto their store when Ubisoft can have their own separate store? And, you know, this is the thing that Valve transcended by not really caring about that shit and just kind of inviting everyone on. Kind of. But it's been very, very good for them, because the best-selling games on Steam are Valve games.
It's, like, I just think it's trickier. I think, in terms of, like, yeah, big industry-defining impact, both Blizzard and Valve are bigger, but I would defend BioWare almost, in addition to the design innovation stuff, also the aesthetic sensibility, particularly the way they advanced, like, a more socially progressive style of game narrative.
I kind of think that would have happened though, it might have been retarded by a couple of years, but that's the thing
I find harder to pinpoint who would have done it, because I totally agree that you could go to like Richard Garriott or any number of other old RPG designers who could have produced, you know, action games with a big RPG element or a narrative element and so on. But in terms of like having created that fan culture around particular set of characters and stories and stuff, like, no one else really does that apart from, I mean, Blizzard obviously have a bit of that, but their stories are on a different and lower level. I don't know. I think it's a really genuinely hard decision, but I would save BioWare just because I feel like it took Valve to do a lot of things that other companies didn't want to do, but a lot of what Valve does is build a structure around the things that the community kind of needs, like, or that the community is already half providing for itself, but could provide better. So, like, the community was distributing Counter-Strike patches to itself kind of fine, but they decided you can make this easier, and hence Steam. Like, if they didn't exist, I think Counter-Strike would probably still be a thing. I think Dota would still be a thing, and it'd be very interesting to see what state those things were in, and maybe we'd be playing Riot Games as Dota now, or we'd be playing S2 Games as Dota or something like that.
And we'd be connecting to them all through the GameSpy server browser and downloading our patches from FilePlanet.
Yeah, exactly. If you're thinking about it, I wonder if
Valve killed the noughties.
I wonder if Blizzard's absence from the industry might actually have... It would certainly have... I think out of all three of them, I think Blizzard's absence would have had the greatest effect, but I don't know whether it would necessarily be altogether bad. Like, I mean, because if WoW hadn't existed, then perhaps the MMO genre would have been more diverse earlier, for one thing. Everybody looked at WoW's amazing success and they tried to copy that. Whereas I think perhaps if there hadn't been such a market leader, we would have had a more diverse genre.
Yeah, SOE might still be around, like doing things like Vanguard, which were sort of failed experiments post EverQuest in that kind of weird branch of the MMO where it was all about building things and, you know, early precursors to Minecraft servers, basically. Like, that kind of thing maybe would have become more prominent.
I think in WoW's kind of golden age, there were such tremendous technical restrictions on what an MMO could be in terms of the interactions that you could have in an MMO. There were kind of MMO shooter hybrids that just didn't work very well because server technology simply couldn't support that level of, you know.
Well, the first plan side.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And they found the format that could be done, and people tried to find a better, different, you know, more interesting attractions. No one really did it.
I think the thing is that Blizzard's, like, the thing that unifies all Blizzard games is they have to be polished. Like, they have to feel really good, and they have to, like, run comfortably on a bunch of systems at the time when they are launched. Mm. And that, I think, leads to the thing that people probably don't say about Blizzard enough, or doesn't mention enough, because the games are great, but they're all, like, technologically retrograde. Like, Blizzard games always feel retro, like, even relative to the time that they're released in. They might look nice because of great creative art design and stuff like that, but they are never boundary-pushing technologically. Mm. And I think the fact that World of Warcraft worked so well, like, it ran beautifully, like, they found the things you could do in an MMO that work repeatably. But in doing so, they basically killed a whole generation of more experimental games that were willing to be a bit janky in order to try and furnish an experience that wouldn't necessarily be smooth. Like, which is actually, that's probably the unifying theme of SOE's output in those years immediately preceding WoW, where you have PlanetSide and EverQuest and things EverQuest was doing with housing and stuff like that, and Star Wars Galaxies. And things like Second Life as well, which was janky as all fuck, but, like, vastly, vastly ambitious in terms of what it wanted to be. And, you know, Blizzard's thing is like, well, we could try and be, rather than sort of like that kind of like really big theoretical ambition, it's just like, let's make the nicest, most fun thing we can make and finish to a high degree of quality, which is laudable, but
not irreplaceable.
It's not, it's not irreplaceable.
You can make the same. Sorry, go on.
Oh, sorry. I think, like, financial success is a big factor in this as well. Like, the fact that the industry is as big as it is because games have sold so incredibly well, especially given that games haven't broken into mainstream culture in the way that, you know, you might expect for a business that large. I think a lot of the reasons that way games continue to be made is because there's so much money in and around games that encourages people to take risks and to go into the industry. And a game like WoW that is such an enormous moneymaker, and even a Call of Duty or something like that, by the simple gravitational pull of money, actually is incredibly influential and encourages people to chase it and to want to try and make a company in the industry of games. And just economically, I think that's hugely influential.
Mm. I think I would probably condemn Valve, genuinely.
Yeah, I might do as well. But, oh, well, Steam.
I think
Steam is, I think Graham's point is a good point, actually. Like, Steam has done so much for PC gaming.
It has. But.
And I think, would someone else have made it?
No, I don't think anybody would have for a long time. Yeah, I think we would be like a decade behind on PC now. I think maybe even the PC as a gaming platform would not have flourished in the way it has.
It wasn't for Valve. It was pretty shriveled. That's the thing that's easy to forget now, is just how few games were actually coming out on PC. And it wasn't true.
It could be like Mac gaming, you know?
Yeah. There's a real risk of that. So there's an argument to be made that Counter-Strike did a similar thing to World of Warcraft in terms of, you know, the Half-Life mod community and the Quake mod community would make really experimental, strange multiplayer first-person stuff, things like Science and Industry and Jailbreak. But Counter-Strike's phenomenal popularity, where it was popular than all of the commercial games, multiplayer games put together, just meant that they created a pattern for success that all the mods started copying and a lot of the commercial games started copying as well. And it's only really maybe the last couple of years that the ease of making first-person stuff in Unity has allowed a kind of more experimental first-person games to come back again.
I mean, do you guys think that Half-Life is disposable then in the same way, or Half-Life 2 rather is disposable in the same way? Because it took a long, long time for other games to match Half-Life 2.
I think, but I think games are still disregarding those lessons every.
Oh yeah,
most
yeah.
of them do. Like,
so maybe that's an argument for maybe, it being irrelevant. In that yeah. sense, it wouldn't have made a difference because it didn't.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was too hard for most people to do that. That kind of, yeah, that level of tutorial stuff. You get something like Dead Space popping up, and it's like written in blood on the wall. It's like chop the arms off by pressing the rotate gun button, and that's still pretty
instead
much
of dying man with his, he wrote the words with his arm stump.
Yeah, and that's still pretty much the default. Level of, yeah. kind of tutorial you get from games. So
it's not just that though. It's always, I mean, I like Alex as a character. Obviously, today we might look at that as being fairly basic in terms of, you know, interaction with a companion. But it did take ages before any company even attempted something similar to that.
That's true. And it has been like 14 years.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, yeah. Is that good or bad? Is it a good
what
good
I mean
bad
is
it, in
again,
their favour?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how difficult this question is to answer. Mm. Like, I think maybe the sensible decision is to say lose BioWare, but I'd hate that.
Also, fuck time travel, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck time travel. Yeah, we might, you know, what happens if we get rid of these companies? Maybe, you know, the next Hitler won't be born or will be born.
Well, the next Hitler won't be born. No, no.
Another sequel. You know, that's what's wrong with this industry.
If you get rid of Half-Life 1, then I'd probably never become a game.
You do realize Hitlers aren't like slayers from Buffy, Mark. Sure you understand that. Wow. It's not like one born into every generation.
We only need to see what time travel did to the X-Men franchise to know that it's a bad fucking idea.
Yeah. Well, David ends this email by saying, P.S., the question was a lie. This has actually already happened. Why did you let them erase Royal Purple Studios, you monsters? James writes, Dear mighty crates-wielding crowbars, a few weeks ago, the group discussed that scientific research does not work quite like it does in games like XCOM. Typically, research is done and viable uses are extrapolated from the results of that research. This is opposite to the video game standard of research laser guns straight to get laser guns. While it's basically true, I present my favourite research in XCOM Enemy Unknown as an exception to the standard. Precision laser beam weapons. The flavour text that appears when that research finishes explains that the first experiments were complete failures but could potentially be repurposed. There is another paragraph that explains that the scientists started with a new approach and achieved the desired result on the second try. This research unlocks the ability to build laser shotguns, called laser scatter guns, and laser sniper rifles. Scientists tried to focus lasers to create long-range precision weaponry, initially failed, and instead discovered a way to shoot out an unfocused blast of short-range lasers. So they accidentally created the ability to make laser shotguns make a laser sniper rifle.
Huh.
James.
Yeah, so it was a nice example of good flavour text.
Good flavour. I don't think I've read a
tasty flavour text.
The thing that we were talking about in the previous podcast is that science in games tends to go towards a particular goal and then achieves it, whereas obviously science in reality just plows ahead in some direction and then by serendipity discovers other kind of applications of it which weren't expected.
Max Usher writes, so what's your take on Elite Dangerous Arena, which was just announced and released today, which is Frontier taking the close quarters combat mode from Elite Dangerous and releasing it as a standalone game for £5 on Steam or via the Frontier store. The idea being that it maybe acts as a stepping stone to the larger game, and that people who are intimidated by the larger game might prefer something that they can play in like 20-minute bursts, like you would do Call of Duty, where you just fly around and shoot other ships, level up, unlock new loadouts, practicing your piloting and stuff like that, without the having to do hours and hours of space tracking to get the space credits to buy the better spaceship and all that sort of stuff.
So CQC, if you're unaware that it exists, because I think a lot of people, even though people who know Elite, maybe haven't played it, is like a straight up deathmatch, team deathmatch, capture the flag mode built within Elite using a fixed set of ships that aren't your own. So it's not your main ship. Couple of ships in the main game, Eagle and the Sidewinder are in there, plus ones that aren't currently in the main game, like the Federation fighter and the Imperial fighter.
Yeah.
But which will almost certainly be in the main game when they add ship launch fighters, because those are the fighters that will be launching from the ships.
Hmm.
That's how that works. That's actually one of the reasons I thought they were going to do ship launch fighters, because they announced before they announced it, because they'd added all these working fighters to CQC. But it's much more of an arcade game. It has respawns, it has power-ups, it has that kind of thing. It has, and it has unlocks, and you level up and get new parts of your ships and new ships and so on. And I've played quite a lot of it, and it's all right. I'm really interested to see how this works. I think the unspoken thing here is that making it more available and putting more of a push behind it and giving it a catchier name than CQC is hopefully a way to drive up the amount of people playing it. Because matchmaking is a problem and has been for a while. Mm. It takes a while to find a game. Some modes you just can't find games for, and it can't afford to have particularly like skill or level range diverse matchmaking. So it's everyone with everyone else. And because of the unlock system, time spent does make a difference. And I mean, after like you play for a couple of hours, you'll get a ship that's pretty good in most situations, and then it is down to skill, but like it still helps. And so you will have, there's a lot of games that I've played which have like everyone else is having a fairly close game and one guy who's level 48 is just playing his own game and can't be killed.
How does capturing the flag work?
It's like you have to fly to a point and like get it.
You just fly through it.
Yeah.
It picks it up. Yeah, okay, like right. Cargo. Right, sure. Yeah.
It's nice in the way that, like, you know, Elite has interesting combat. It feels a little bit faster paced, and they've done a good job with the maps, actually. Like, you're always, like, around a space station in an asteroid field or something, so there are actually obstacles and things. It's not just a big free-for-all in open space. But it feels a very different game to Elite in some ways, because you're not managing subsystems to anywhere near the same degree. You kind of have a limited number of loadouts and that kind of thing. I'll be interested to see if people take to it who haven't necessarily played Elite, because I found that I was capable of taking to it quite quickly, but only because I played so much Elite that the basic rudiments of flying a ship in that game and moving power around are second nature, which helps a great deal. Whereas if you're new to that, this is actually probably the worst way to learn, because even though Elite is slow, Elite is like, take your time. Like, space is going to still be there. Like, just fucking potter while you learn how to dock and get used to shunting the ship around, because it's not intuitive. Whereas this is like, you're in a deathmatch. Oh, you didn't move fast. You're dead now. And so, like, for me, it's almost like the least accessible version of Elite. So I'll be interested to see how it works as an outreach tool. Particularly compared to something like Strike Vector, which is probably the game that it's closest to, which was the indie sort of dogfighting mech.
It's really cool. I really
like
it.
Which was great, and no one is playing it now. Yeah, I went back on a tour of brilliant multiplayer games released in 2014 that no one is playing now. Really? Strike Vector and Blade Symphony. Blade Symphony is better off, because Blade Symphony is fucking great, and you can still play Blade Symphony games. But CQC is a lot slower. In a good way, I think. But I don't know. I feel like someone out there is going to make the brilliant dogfighting esport. And I really want someone to make that, as someone who covers esports, because I want to interview the guy who was like actually the greatest starfighter pilot in the world. CQC feels a little bit level dependent. I hate unlock systems in multiplayer games as it is. I really fucking hate it. So that's a disappointment that's the way it gates progress. I'd like it to do well, certainly, like, because they've definitely tried putting some competitive sort of heft behind it, and hopefully if this results in a flood of new players, then the whole experience will lift, because it will suddenly have a much bigger matchmaking pool. It'll be easier to find fair matches for people and so on. But I would still probably just recommend people play Elite, honestly, because that will teach you all the things you need to know in a much safer environment. That said, I don't know if they've revamped any of the tutorials or something with Arena, so with that caveat. You played it, Graham?
I haven't, actually, no, but I spoke to David Braben about it when he was in town a couple of weeks ago. Mm. It seems like a smart idea to do it, to try it. And I can understand why. Yeah, I agree with you that Elite Dangerous has that kind of slower pace, so you can just float around where you're experimenting with things rather than getting shot. But there's also it's intimidating for a lot of people to just be in an open world without a clear objective, where for some people, more so than getting blown up every 10 seconds while you're trying to work out how to do stuff. So I, like you, kind of hope it does well. But I always have a problem with those kind of dogfighting games, in that so much of what's interesting about shooters is positioning, is hiding behind things, is having some sense of that person has the higher ground. I am behind cover. And is you can kind of do that with Asteroids, and Elite has cool stuff in terms of like trying to mask your heat signature and that kind of thing. But I never find fully three-dimensional space games as distinct from space games that fulfilling stuff like Descent, where you can just get shot in your underbelly, that kind of thing. So I wonder if that's probably a larger obstacle towards it becoming a huge success than the complexity of it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it hits all sorts of problems with, like, it's easier if you have a flight stick. Like, it hits this sort of run of things you encounter when you're making a flight simulator that actually having the tools that were designed for flying things is better than having a control pad or a mouse and keyboard. And all that stuff sort of adds up when you have then a competitive game on top of it. It's something that, yeah, so like I desperately want it to exist and I'd like it to do well. But I would certainly, like, I would worry that someone would play it and go, I don't like this, who might actually get something out of just delivering fish in space.
Which is also the thing that I like about Elite Dangerous. I am much more of a space trucker.
So yeah, I wouldn't consider it the demo for Elite Dangerous because at no point do you learn how to park.
And that's all the time for questions that we have.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can also leave a forum on the questions. You can leave a question on the questions from the forum at creightoncrowbar.com. Tom.
I felt really confident going into this.
You were doing... It sounded like you knew what you were going to say.
I really did.
Drink some more. That'll help. There you go. Now fully lubricated. Which will attempt this again.
You can post a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. You can also tweet us your questions at Crate and Crowbar. If you'd like to talk to us on Discord, that's where our community tends to hang out, arrange games, discuss MOBAs and television and whether or not PC Gamer is real.
Oh, yeah.
Best discussion.
Or whether we secretly folded 4 years ago. You can find the link to our Discord, because it has to use some kind of weird Discord invite link, in the sidebar of the website. That is, once again, creightoncrowbar.com. If you'd like to follow us as individuals on Twitter, you can do so. I am at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N, and this is Chris talking.
Tom talking here, and I'm at PCG Ludo.
Marsh talking, that's Marsh Davis. D-A-V-I-E-S.
Graham talking, it's at Gunnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
Goodbye, Graham.
Goodbye Graham. Marsh.
Aww. If you love someone, set them free.
Driving Graham out into the woods, opening the car door and saying, goodbye, Graham.
I'm going to go be with my family now.
In the woods.
Sounds like a euphemism. So many fucking politicians quitting to spend more time with their family.
Yeah. Have you fucked a child? Was this is about?
No.
We could have actually not told anyone about you going to like the big Graham farm, going to live on the big Graham farm, and just replace you with an identical Graham.
Oh my God,
the kids would never have known.
This is like Animal Farm. Just going to turn Graham to glue.
So the people who can't differentiate our voices have no idea who's leaving or staying.
Those people are fine, but for the few of you who can tell who the fuck is talking now, we're sorry and goodbye.
Plans for listening,
everybody. Honk, honk.
Meep, meep.
Honk, honk.
Meep. Meep.
Good.
Goodbye to the Patreon subscribers. This special episode.